Welcome to this election year special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio. We are going to spend the next hour talking to Gary Peters, the Democratic candidate for Michigan's open U.S. Senate seat. We'll be talking with Congressman Peters about issues that matter to Michigan voters, and we know that because the questions, they're coming from you, from jobs to taxes, foreign affairs to the environment. This is your chance to ask the questions of the candidates. The phone number to join the conversation is 313-577-1019. Again, 313-577-1019. In this first segment, we'll be discussing national security and foreign policy. Have you been following the protests in Ferguson, Missouri? Do you think the United States should send troops into Iraq again? Do you have questions about the future of immigration legislation? Call us now with your questions about what's going on at home and overseas. You can also message us on Facebook. We are at the page Michigan Calling. Tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. And a quick note before we go right to your questions, we will also be doing a call-in show with the Republican candidate, Terry Lynn Land. That show will air October 3rd. Both Peters and Land are looking to fill the seat that is currently held by the retiring and venerable Democratic Senator Carl Levin. You should also know both candidates accepted our invitation without negotiations or conditions set in advance regarding topics, format, follow-up questions. They simply agreed to show up and answer questions. So, on to the job interview. Congressman Peters, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And why would I negotiate anything with you? I'm sure this is going to be a great opportunity.
All right, let's start with worldwide events from the fighting in Syria and Gaza, what's going on in Iraq. We have a host of issues dealing with international affairs and national security. And our first question comes from Michael on Facebook. And Michael asks, Congressman Peters, how will you differ from Senator Levin on the National Defense Authorization Act and congressional authorization of indefinite detention of American citizens? Indefinite detention of American citizens.
Well, there should never be indefinite detention of American citizens. That there are constitutional rights that citizens have for detention, and make sure that their case is heard. And I will support the Constitution.
Are those rights being respected right now?
Well, we have to constantly be vigilant of that, and I will stand up and constantly fight to make sure that those constitutional rights are there. That's what I will do when I'm the next United States Senator.
Are those rights being respected right now?
The constitutional rights of
People, indefinite detention.
Well, if you're in indefinite detention, no, they're not. You need to have your day in court.
Okay. Going on, we've got some calls lining up on the phone right now, and we're going to go to... Let's talk a little bit about international crises. There's the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the rebellion in eastern Ukraine, the political and military transition in Afghanistan, China. When you look at all of those, as a U.S. senator, where would you set your priorities in terms of U.S. focus?
Well, I think right now our focus, we can't keep our or can't take our eye off the ball when it comes to Iran and their nuclear ambitions. I'm looking very closely at what's happening there with the negotiations. Certainly, you mentioned all of the hot spots that are out there. It's a very tumultuous time right now for the world as you look around. But as this is occurring, we have to remember that we have Iran, which is working on a nuclear weapon. And if they were to get a nuclear weapon, it would upset the balance to a considerable margin throughout the Middle East. To me, that's unacceptable. I've spent some time when I was in the United States Navy and spent some time looking out over the Straits of Hormuz and saw the line of tankers that transit that very narrow portion in the Persian Gulf with Iran. And to think that Iran would have a nuclear weapon is simply unacceptable, really, for world security. So to me, that frightens me, that you'd have a country that has shown their willingness to engage in terrorist activities or support terrorist activities. And to have a weapon of that magnitude is a frightening prospect.
Okay. Let's talk quickly about Iraq. The situation on the ground in the north is deteriorating. The president has authorized airstrikes to protect American civilians there, and not to mention the religious minorities. What role should the U.S. play in moving Iraq forward?
Well, the only solution for Iraq is a political solution. Iraq has to be able to put together the political pieces and the coalition necessary to stabilize the government. And that means all of the various factions in Iraq need to have a place at the table. They have to feel that their voice is being heard and that they all have a stake in the governance of that country. So that has to be our focus, and that's what we have to continue to be pushing. And there's some changes, as you know, in the government in Iraq, which the world community has seen as positive. Hopefully that is indeed the case, that it's positive. But ultimately, it's got to be a political solution.
Is there a moral obligation on the part of the United States to prevent the massacre of civilians in Iraq?
Well, certainly if there's opportunities to stop some imminent harm, and when we're dealing with certainly American citizens as well, we had a situation.
But we're talking about innocent civilians in Iraq.
Well, I think if there's opportunities to do that, you should do that. But I think we also need to have a long-term strategy. You've got to have a long-term plan. And part of my frustration with what we're seeing now is that we haven't had a briefing. We haven't had any classified briefings as to what's happening on the ground in Iraq, what has been the president's response. I mean, I'm willing to go back to Washington, D.C. today if he calls a meeting with Congress to talk about what's happening on the ground there. I'd certainly like to have a briefing and would have questions of the generals from the Defense Department who are involved in that operation. But, you know, the
why isn't the administration sharing that information with you?
I don't. That's a question you have to ask of them.
What have they told you?
We haven't said why. We just haven't had those briefings. Now, Congress is not in session now, but I would say that I would come back in order to do that. You know, but I am concerned with what's on the ground. You know, we have a very large Chaldean population here in my district, Chaldean, which are the Christian Iraqis who have been pushed out of that.
When you say your district in Southeast Michigan, in Metro Detroit.
Michigan. That's correct. In my congressional district, and I've worked very closely with the Chaldean community. I'm a member of the Religious Minorities Caucus in the U.S. House, concerned about the variety of religious minorities that exist throughout the Middle East. Those Chaldean Christians have been moved out of their traditional homeland, have been protected by Kurdish forces right now, and we've got a good relationship with the Kurds and with the United States, and the Kurds are certainly in a position, I think, to protect those minorities. And, you know, there's no question it's a humanitarian crisis when you have folks going across the border seeking safety in what is just an incredibly dangerous part of the world.
What if an air campaign alone is not sufficient to the task? At what point do you, as a United States senator, vote to authorize actually putting troops back in, putting boots on the ground?
Well, at this point, I would not support putting boots on the ground in Iraq. I do not think that's we do not need to be back there and on the ground. We have airstrikes now to the extent that airstrikes can do it, although, you know, there's a limit to what you can possibly do with airstrikes. But I would not support boots on the ground.
What would it take for you to support boots on the ground?
That's too hypothetical to say what that is. But I have not seen that. And I will just say that, you know, I served in the United States Navy Reserve, and I take the decision of whether or not to send men and women into harm's way very seriously. It's probably the most difficult decision you can possibly make. And I remember the men and women that I served with, and that's going to be always in the back of my mind before that decision is made, one way or the other. But at this point, I see no reason to be back in Iraq with boots on the ground. And even with airstrikes, you need to have a longer-term plan to go forward. And I'd like to get a better sense of what that is. It's one thing to deal with the immediate crisis and to save lives, and when you had people trapped on a mountaintop and other things that were of real concern, you deal with that, but you've got to have a longer-term plan. And I don't see that as really being articulated at this point, and I think it's a serious matter.
Okay, we have a phone call now from Paul in Ann Arbor. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Good morning. Congressman, my question is about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are people, and I think even the Obama administration, occasionally critical of the Israeli government. I wonder what your view is about the Israelis' ability to defend themselves and what I view, at least, as Hamas using their civilians as shields for their military actions.
Well, certainly Israel has the right to defend herself, and you cannot have indiscriminate rocket attacks against your country and not respond to that. And Israel is responding to Hamas's attacks of rockets. You know, I have had the opportunity to travel to the Middle East, and one of those places that I was at was in Sderot, which is near Gaza. It's a place where those indiscriminate rockets fly into Sderot, and we visited an armored playground where children were in a armored bunker because they could not play outside. The rocket attacks, when they occur, happen so quickly, children wouldn't be able to find shelter. In my mind, no child anywhere in the world should have to live in those kinds of conditions. And in fact, we talked to a young mother who said that her young son always touches the walls wherever they go out in town. She touches the walls and asks his mother, rather, are these walls strong enough? Are they safe? So, you know, Israel has a right to defend herself. Hamas needs to stop the rocket attacks. You can't live in that situation. You can just imagine if Canada was lobbing rockets at the United States, we would act very aggressively to stop those rocket attacks. So in the short run, Hamas has to do that. Hamas, is bad for the Palestinian people and the Israeli people. They need to stop those actions.
I've got to ask you to keep the answer very short, but what can the United States do to reassert itself as a player in the peace negotiations between Palestine and Israel? I mean, John Kerry was basically ignored by President Netanyahu in the last go round.
Well, we have to continue to try to assert ourselves in there and make sure that we are the honest broker. We've got to continue to be seen as the honest broker about bringing these parties together. But it's also going to take the world community coming together. But bottom line, you have to stop rocket attacks. Once the rockets stop, you can then work to get people to the table.
But what's
to talk
one
about
thing
issues
that the United States could do today to engage or re-engage in that particular process?
Well, I think you got to put more pressure on Hamas, and Hamas has to understand that is simply unacceptable to be sending rockets in an indiscriminate fashion. The world community will not stand for that. And so that's building support globally as well for that.
Okay. Thank you, Congressman. We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, more of your questions for the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate. You are listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Gary Peters on the Michigan Public Radio Network. Welcome back. I'm Rick Pluta here with the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate, Congressman Gary Peters, and we are taking your questions on the economy, energy, and the environment in this segment. The number is 313-577-1019. Again, that's 313-577-1019. You can also ask a question on Facebook. Find us at Michigan Calling. Tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. Congressman, let's talk a little bit about what's been described as the militarization of police departments across the country, that it's become common for departments to get to be able to purchase surplus military assault vehicles, some major league weapons. Is it appropriate for the federal government to be selling this kind of high-powered military equipment to any local government that's willing to write a check?
Well, I think it is right to be asking some very serious questions about that. And I know Senator Levin, for example, is going to be looking into that in a very detailed way. As chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, I'm going to be looking and with great interest at the hearings that he will be holding on those issues. There are going to be similar activities in the House as well. I think we have to balance. Obviously, police departments also want to have the ability to deal with what could be potentially extremely dangerous situations for them. If you've got an armed gunman in a blockade situation, you put men and women in law enforcement at great risk to deal with that situation. You want to make sure they have the equipment necessary to protect their lives and to project force necessary to bring that standoff to an end. You may have terrorist threats. You may have drug cartels. Whatever it may be, you need to have that force. But I think what we're seeing in Ferguson, obviously, is that there needs to be protocols as to when that equipment is used, and there needs to be very strict guidelines. Where those guidelines are, I think we've got to ask a lot of questions and get a lot of input as to where we've got to go forward. But there's no question what we are seeing is incredibly troubling.
Okay. Should mandatory training be an element of any of those sorts of equipment sales?
Well, there's no question. The men and women who operate that equipment need to be trained. The United States military is the best trained military force on the planet. We don't send our men and women into harm's way with equipment that they're not fully trained on using.
I meant more an appropriate use when, you know, when to deploy something like that.
Oh, the same thing. You know, and certainly, you know, we see that in the United States military. We have rules of engagement. You have military JAG officers that accompany battlefield commanders.
Military attorneys.
Military attorneys that are there with military commanders making sure that the rules of war are being followed and that the rules that we have in place as to when to engage in lethal combat are appropriate. There's no difference for a police force. So we certainly have those kinds of protocols in place for the United States military. We need to have those protocols for our local law enforcement as well.
Okay, well, let's take a phone call from East Lansing. Linda, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask Congressman Peters, what is his intention in taking some leadership on bringing gun sense to America? Specifically, I want to encourage him to complete the Every Town for Gun Safety campaign questionnaire that he received. And I would like him to speak specifically to background checks for gun sales, all gun sales, and what sort of leadership he might provide in that area.
Okay, Linda, thank you for your call.
Well, thank you, Linda. And I think this is a very important topic. And it's actually a topic that I feel very strongly about and have been frustrated in the United States Congress that we weren't able to bring a vote for a measure to have universal background checks. Now, I think that is where we need to go. It's a proposal that is supported by, I think the last opinion polls I saw is 90% of the American people. Even folks who are gun owners, members of the NRA, they're rank-and-file members supported by well over 70%. And it's very, it's just a common
sense. What constitutes a background check?
Background check.
An acceptable one.
Well, it's the process we have now, unfortunately, which is to see if folks have criminal records, if they have restraining orders, a list of things that would prevent someone from buying a weapon. But under current law, there are glaring loopholes. In fact, I believe it's up to 40% of all weapon sales are done without a background check. That has to be closed. And we have some pretty horrific stories. There was a story recently in Wisconsin with a gentleman who had a restraining order against him. His wife or his estranged wife was afraid of him because of the divorce they were going through. She had a restraining order, but he went to and bought a weapon legally through because of the loophole from the gun show, I believe. And then he went in the next day and killed his wife, another coworker, and then put the gun on himself and shot himself. You know, here's clearly a person who should never have had that weapon. We need to have universal background checks. You know, I'm a gun owner myself. It's not anti-gun at all. Law-abiding citizens will have nothing to fear from having that background check. And to me, it is frustrating that you have a situation here with 90% support of the American people. I don't know of any other issue that has. There's very few that would have 90% support from the American people. But we couldn't even get a vote in the Senate because they wouldn't override the filibuster. And our leadership, the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives, won't even put the bill on the floor. My mind is put the bill on the floor. I've signed discharge petitions for a bill that we have in the House in order to have universal background checks. Just put the bill on the floor and let members of Congress go home, depending if they vote yes or no, and stand up to the people. That's the way this American system is supposed to work. We need common sense problem solving, common sense solutions, and that's why folks are so frustrated with Congress right now. But I will continue.
Is the filibuster rule abused?
It is.
Would you support reforming it as
yes.
a member of the United States Senate?
Yes.
Would you end it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, my view is, well, I should say, you know, the rule that we have where you just file a piece of paper. If someone wants to filibuster, that's certainly allowed. If you want to get up on the Senate floor and talk for 24 hours and speak your mind, that's fine. That's democracy in work. But when your 24 hours are done, or however long you last on the floor when you sit down, then the people's work has to go forward, and let's have up or down votes.
So you mean the
bills.
Talking filibuster, that you speak till you're done, but
that's
you've got to do it, no bathroom breaks, no, you're there.
Right,
okay.
Right. That's allowed, but not the procedure where then you need to have, someone just files a piece of paper. That's unacceptable.
We're going to talk immigration, and Brian Watson asks us on Twitter, Congressman, what does a secure border look like to you?
Well, we have to make every measure to make the border as secure as possible and have the resources necessary to prevent folks from coming over in an undocumented basis. That's why I support the comprehensive immigration reform bill that came out of the United States Senate. In that bill, I believe there's over $40 billion of additional money to support border security issues, which is an important part of immigration reform. But, you know, we have to look at immigration reform in a much broader sense as well. And that's really should be the main focus of immigration reform, is looking at all of the aspects of immigration reform and not any one particular piece.
How do you view the issue of the tens of thousands of child immigrants who are coming here mostly from Honduras, mm-hmm. El Salvador, Guatemala, and we know that some of them are coming into Michigan. How do you view that specific question, these child migrants?
Well, as they come across, under U.S. law, they are allowed to have a hearing, which I believe originated back in the Bush administration, to make sure that these children have a hearing to know whether or not they have status to be here, perhaps on a refugee basis, if they're going to be facing persecution or violence back home, dependent on the criteria set out in the law. So they need to have their due process, but if they don't meet those criteria, they need to be sent back to their home.
Do you see this specific question as an immigration issue, or is this more of a refugee situation?
Well, it could be a refugee situation if they qualify under the refugee status and would be admitted into the United States as a refugee. And certainly we have refugees here in the greater Detroit area as well. So that's the status of it. But that means we do need to have comprehensive immigration reform as well. We can't keep ignoring this problem. And it's the same thing. We had comprehensive immigration reform.
What are the critical elements of comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, there's several elements. Obviously, enforcement is part of that element, but you also have to have a way to allow folks who want to come to our country legally, who want to pursue the American dream. This is what this country was built upon, was immigrants. You and I are immigrants. My mother's a naturalized citizen. My father was, our family traces back to the Sons of the American Revolution, so we're an old family and a new family. It's what America is. So part of immigration reform is to make processes work for farmers, for example, in the agricultural community here in Michigan. They have some serious challenges with trying to get workers to do work in their farms to harvest our crops. We need to have a system that works for that. We have to have a system that allows entrepreneurs and folks who want to come and invest in this country have an opportunity to come here legally and help build our economy. In fact, I think it's interesting that if you look at successful venture capital companies in this country, nearly 40% of ones that go public are started by an immigrant. They bring a great deal of intellectual capital and can bring financial capital to us. Those are very important elements. And then we have to deal with the 11 million plus folks who are here on an undocumented basis right now, and part of immigration reform allows folks.
Should there be a path to citizenship?
Yes, they would have a path. They'd get to the back of the line. They would have to pay all their taxes, make sure there's no criminal record. They have to learn English. And in the comprehensive immigration reform bill, it'd take about 13 years for someone to go through that. But it's important to bring folks out of the shadows. And that's why I've supported the DREAM Act, which allows children who came here with their parents, came here when they were very young. And I deal with these cases on a regular basis in my congressional office. You have children that had come to this country when they're 5 years old with their parents. They came here on an undocumented basis. They didn't come here on their own. They were brought here by their parents, and they know no other life except being an American, growing up in American mm-hmm. schools and know English, don't know their home country. And they should have an opportunity. If they go to college, if they serve in the military, they should have an opportunity to stay in this country. In fact, I had a woman who was a valedictorian of her high school and was going to go on to medical school or hoped to go to medical school, was admitted to the University of Michigan. But she was brought here as a very young child, and the folks wanted to deport her. It makes no sense for someone who knows nothing about their home country, or not even their language, and grew up in America. It's that kind of common sense problem solving that we need in Congress. We need to see more common sense.
Okay, so many questions, so little little time. We're going to shift to energy and the environment, and we have Charlie in Holland joining us. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Does Gary Peters support cap and trade?
Congressman, are you a cap and trade fan?
Well, I think, you know, cap and trade is an option that we need to look at. It has been successful in other areas. In fact, we saw that in acid rain when we had to mitigate acid rain. Cap and trade program actually reduced acid rain emissions while doing it in a very cost-effective way. You've seen some programs similar to that in New England now, actually, that when it comes to carbon emissions, that have reduced carbon emissions while the New England economy is doing very well. So it's certainly something on the table that we have to take a look at as we reduce carbon emissions. But there is not a specific proposal before us right now to comment. But I think it's important to make sure that we're looking at all of the kind of market-based solutions. Cap and trade is a market-based solutions. So if a caller believes in markets, you know, that's probably something the caller is interested in, because if you believe in markets, cap and trade is part of that.
Okay. You would agree that we are too reliant on the Middle East for our energy needs. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Republicans have been very critical of Democrats for being critical of policies that make us more reliant on Middle East oil, but not being supportive enough of more immediate domestic sourcing of energy. For example, natural gas drilling. Where are you on that?
Well, I'm that the only energy policy that works is an all of the above strategy. Is that we have to have very diverse sources of energy in order to meet the demands that we have in our country. Certainly alternative energy is very important. Renewable energy is important, whether it's biofuels or solar or wind. Natural gas, of course, has been great for the country as those explorations have opened up. But we also have to do it in a safe way, in a way that will protect the environment. So when you're dealing with issues like fracking, for example, I've co-sponsored legislation to make sure that fracking operations are brought into the Clean Water Act and are brought into the Safe Drinking Water Act, so that when we engage in these activities, we do it in a safe way. You know, I think it's...
Can fracking be done safely?
Well, I think we've got to make sure we're regulating it and making sure that there is the oversight that's necessary to that it's done properly. You know, I never look, and I get frustrated with folks who see being strong on the environment and good for the economy as mutually exclusive. They're not. Those are what ideologues like to think. In my mind, you can do what's good for the economy. You can do what's good for the environment. They can coexist together, and it's those kinds of common sense kinds of approaches to the issues that we so desperately need in Congress, and that's why I'm running for the U.S. Senate.
Do you support the Keystone Pipeline?
I believe that we've got to ask more questions on the Keystone Pipeline. And one thing we've got to do, of course, is there are some court cases on the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska. We've got farmers in the middle part of the country that's very concerned about the Keystone and the potential problems that would occur if you have a pipeline break. And those of us in Michigan, of all places, should really appreciate why folks are concerned about a pipeline break when we had the Enbridge pipeline break here in Michigan, which I believe at this point is the most expensive pipeline break in the history of the United States, with Canadian tar sands oil, which is heavy oil that sinks. It's very, very much more difficult to clean up in water. It can be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. So you're
not there yet on the Keystone Pipeline.
Well, I think you've got state court cases that need to go forward, and I don't think the federal government should be ramming a pipeline through a state when states, you know, I believe in states.
Are Democrats stalling the Keystone Pipeline?
I just want to make sure that it's being done in a proper way. And, you know, part of that proper way also deals with petcoke, an issue that I dealt with here in my district when we had petcoke, which is the residual from refining Canadian tar sands oil, piling up on the Detroit River, blowing into people's lungs, going into the Great Lakes. And we don't have regulations overseeing petcoke. I would like to see, and I've introduced legislation, to say we have to understand best practices, how to deal with petcoke. We also need to have a better understanding of the potential public health issues related to it. And we have to understand that if the Keystone pipeline is built, there's going to be a lot of petcoke in this country, and we need to have regulations in place to deal with it in a safe way. And to me, that's the important thing. These are not mutually exclusive, but let's do things in a thoughtful way instead of having folks who are more based on ideology. These aren't black and white issues. These are mm-hmm. issues that we've got to do things in a thoughtful way.
Okay, let's go to a question from Tom in Detroit. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. Congressman Peters, in regards to the deluge last week that we had here in the Detroit metropolitan area and the infrastructure what are you going to do as a congressman and, you know, when you get to the Senate to, you know, make sure we get the adequate amount of funds here to get this, start working on and improving the infrastructure? And I'll listen offline.
Okay, and I'm going to warn you, you're going to have to answer in like a minute.
Okay, happy to. Well, there's no question. I think that you're absolutely right. Infrastructure is a critical need for us. You know, we're dealing with the aftermath of these floods. I'm happy to say the Department of Transportation, or the Federal Department of Transportation, just sent a $750,000 grant to the state of Michigan to work on cleanup and to shore up some of the infrastructure, the bridges and the like. But we've got to do a lot more. That means we have to have a long-term transportation plan in Congress that is over the next few years, and understand as we're dealing with the deficit, and we have to do that in a thoughtful way, that you've got to set priorities. And there's top of the list for me as a member of Congress and as when I go to the United States Senate is that infrastructure has to be the top of the priorities of what we invest in as a federal government. You've got to have good roads, you've got to have good bridges, or you can't have economic development.
Just very quickly, do you think that a comprehensive solution to the Transportation Trust Fund is possible?
But it's always possible.
It's always possible. Theoretically possible. Okay. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, more of your questions for the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, Congressman Gary Peters. You are listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Gary Peters on the Michigan Public Radio Network. Welcome back to Michigan Calling. I am Rick Pluta. I'm the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm here with Congressman Gary Peters. He is the Democratic nominee for Michigan's U.S. Senate vacancy. And we are taking your calls, your questions. The phone number to join us is 313-577-1019. Again, that is 313-577-1019. You can also message us on Facebook at the Michigan Calling page, or you can tweet us using the hashtag #MICalling. And what questions do you have for Congressman Peters? And we're going to go right to Josh in Saginaw for the first part of this portion. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you.
Your question, Josh.
Sure. So right now, Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage is in the federal courts. And I just wondered where you stand on marriage equality and potentially how this might contrast from Terry Lindland's position.
I support marriage equality. Years and years have supported marriage equality and believe that it's the right thing to do. As far as a contrast, Terry Land, I believe she's opposed to it, but I'd let her say that. It's difficult to know, to be honest with you, some of her positions. She doesn't normally do interviews or answer questions, so it's difficult to know.
But you can ask her on October 3rd. Is there anything more that can be done at the federal level as far as marriage equality?
Well, we're waiting for, obviously, these court cases to
right.
move forward. There have been a number of things that have done at the federal level when it comes to federal employees. But we're hoping that the courts catch up to where the public opinion is, which is broad support for marriage equality that and hopefully we can move forward.
Waiting on the courts. Okay, we're going to go now to Harley in Novi. Harley?
Yes, this is Carly, and Congressman Peters, I have a question. I'm just wondering, speaking of equality, how can you justify paying your female staffers 67 cents on the dollar?
Well, I think she must be referring to the misleading ads that are out there being run against me. You know, sometimes I don't think I'm running against Terry Land. I think I'm running against these out-of-state billionaires that put up ads. In fact, I think just about every ad that they've run has been debunked by all of the fact checkers. You know, the Koch brothers alone. Over
okay, misleading how then?
Well, by not stating facts. And the one ad that she's referring to is basically a flawed study. It was a flawed study of the office. And what wage equality is that if a man and a woman are doing the same job, they should be paid the same amount. And if you actually looked at the study that these folks reference, the women and the men who were in the same job classification, actually, the women were making more money than the men that were in the same job classification. What they looked at was a snapshot of a time where we had a different structure. And in fact, you know, if you have someone who's a receptionist, they will earn less money than the chief of staff in my office. And that's not what what equality is when it comes to wage equality. It's when a man and a woman are doing the same job, they get paid equally, and that study clearly shows that not only were they paid equally, actually the women were paid a little more than the men.
Okay, well then, is that not still pay inequity?
Pardon me?
If the women are making more than the men?
Well, yeah. I mean, you would say that the women made a little bit more, but we're being the facts that they were portraying as facts were not facts at all. It's not accurate.
Okay, we can't go through this without talking about the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. and we have seen the Obama administration delay critical aspects of the act. Your opponent is certainly making an issue of it. How would you fix the ACA?
Well, I think we've got to keep it in place and continue to move forward to make it better and to fix it. But to just repeal it, you know, my opponent just wants to go back and repeal the whole thing and get rid of it, which would, in Michigan, when you look at the fact that we've got well over 300,000 people or families now on Medicaid expansion, you've got close to over 250,000 people in the insurance exchange, you've got hundreds of thousands of people in the state who now have health care coverage that would not have had it without the ACA. You wouldn't have the donut hole plugged for senior citizens, all of the benefits of the ACA. My opponent would just repeal.
Would you vote yes on that same bill if it were put before you today?
Yes. Now the thing is, I know it's not perfect. And when I voted for it, I've never voted for a perfect bill. I never will vote for a perfect bill. I don't think everyone will ever come out of Congress. So what you have to do is you have to go back. You have to make fixes, and where things are not working the way that you thought they were going to work, you make it work. You know, we passed Medicare back in the 1960s. We're constantly going back and fixing Medicare for folks. People aren't saying, let's repeal Medicare. That's something I would be strongly opposed to. In fact, I got an opponent who wants to privatize Medicare and actually increase the cost of Medicare to seniors is what she wants to do. That is not a solution. What we have to do is be thoughtful. We have to be practical. We have to be common sense. And let's make it, because my fundamental belief. And this
what's the number one thing that you would fix in the ACA?
Well, let me just say, and I will do that. But first off, my fundamental belief is that in this country, and this is the greatest country on earth, that everybody, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, should have access to affordable, quality health care. That's what we do in this country. And the Affordable Care Act gets us in that direction. It's not perfect. Let's make some fixes. One of the fixes that, to answer your question, I've actually introduced legislation because I'm particularly concerned about small business. That's really what I focused on my entire time in Congress, is about making sure small business have the tools that they need to be successful, to grow jobs and to grow the economy. And parts of the ACA didn't work that well for small business. We wanted to give an incentive for small businesses who were under the threshold of 50. They weren't required to have insurance, but we wanted to have folks who were in those smaller employers to have access to affordable health care. And so there were tax credits that were available. The tax credits didn't work as well as they should have. There was a lot of bureaucratic problems associated with it, a lot of the qualifications. I've gone back, and I've been working with small business owners, and we've introduced legislation to make that aspect of the ACA work for small businesses. And I will continue to work by consulting with small business owners to make sure it's working properly.
Okay, back to the phones to Alan in Berkeley.
Yes, Congressman. I'm curious on what your views are on outside money. I'm seeing and hearing a lot of stupid, nasty ads, and I'm wondering what the deal is with all the outside money in this race.
Well, unfortunately, there is a lot of outside money coming into this race, and we've seen that. I mentioned earlier in the program the Koch brothers. These are the folks that were piling, in fact, that Petco cup.
Although, in fairness, we should point out that there are a whole variety of interests, not just Americans for Prosperity, that are running ads in these races.
They are. Just none,
on both sides.
None to the extent that they are, of course. You know, it's you do have a lot of outside groups. That's why we have to have campaign finance reform, and I'm a strong proponent of that we can't let these outside groups. I mean, right now, basically on the air, folks are seeing, if you look at folks that are spending money in this race, it's about 2-1 against me. So there's a massive amount of money being spent against me. That's the bad news. So the good news is we're still up in the polls a little bit, which is great, even though we're being outspent 2-1. And I think that ultimately the people of Michigan understand that it's the people of Michigan that are going to have an opportunity to choose their next United States senator. And it's someone who's willing to stand up and fight for middle-class families will be a practical, common-sense problem solver going forward. But having said that, we've got to have campaign finance reform. You can't have these Supreme Court rulings that have basically opened up the floodgates to outside money on both sides that come in. It's perverting the political process. And as I mentioned earlier, the ads that are being run against me, the fact checkers debunk them almost universally. and yet they continue to go up. And I can't fight that unless I have to raise money to try to fight back. The system, it should be about debates. That's why I have agreed to 3 debates. I'd like to do 5 debates. My opponent won't even talk about debates. She won't get on the stage to talk about issues that are important. And I'd like to have her try to defend some of these ads that they're running against me that are just outright false. But she won't get on the stage. She won't debate. And I don't know how you can have a Senate race. This is the first open Senate seat in 20 years and not have a candidate who's willing to get on stage and talk about what they're for. So I hope we'll have debates. I'd love to do a debate with you, Rick. Let's invite me. I've already will accept, and we'll have the opportunity to have a full dialogue.
Well, we will see what happens with debates. And now we have another question.
Congressman, my name is Field Reichert. I'm a Republican from Ottawa County. What would you do as a senator to represent we conservatives over in Western Michigan? My sense is that you are a candidate for the Detroit area. We don't see you over here. How do we know that you are going to do a job representing us?
I'm over in the west side of the state quite a bit. In fact, I was in Muskegon yesterday. I was in Battle Creek. I've been in Grand Rapids many times. So, you know, I take the job of being a representative very seriously. And that means getting out and doing more listening than talking. The West Michigan is a vital part of our state. In fact, the Grand Rapids area is an incredible engine of economic growth for our state. I think we should all be very proud of what we're seeing in Grand Rapids, and I want to celebrate that and be supportive as much as I can to do that in West Michigan. So I'm very used to representing very diverse districts. I've represented some of the wealthiest folks in our state and some of the folks who have some of the largest challenges in our state. And I've been able to actually win in Republican districts. When I won re-election in 2010 over here in southeast Michigan, Governor Snyder won my district by well over 20 points, and yet I still got reelected. There are a lot of folks who are voting for Governor Snyder and voting for Gary Peters, and I hope that will happen in the west side of the state as well, that this should not be about party lines. It shouldn't be about partisanship. It should be about someone who's willing to get out and stand up before voters. And that's why, you know, it's curious that I've got an opponent that won't stand before voters and answer questions. If she's hiding now during an election, what would she do if she was a senator? You'd never see her. Folks are not saying that I'm hiding. I'm out there. I'm answering questions. And as much as I can be on the west side of the state, I'm there, and as well as the northern part. And I look forward to heading to the UP again very shortly, in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, well, let's get to another question. This one from Dora in Port Huron. Hi, Dora.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Dora. Your question for Congressman Peters.
Okay. I live in Port Huron, where the Great Lakes are very important to us economically. And what will you do to protect the Great Lakes in the future?
Well, I appreciate that question. Actually, I just got off of my Great Lakes jobs tour. The last 3 days I've been traveling around. I also traveled with Senator Stabenow talking about the Great Lakes, how important it is to protect them, and how important the Great Lakes are for our economy in Michigan. They're just intertwined. I started off with a tour with a manufacturing plant.
So what needs to be done to protect the Great Lakes? Give us your thumbnail Great Lakes protection agenda.
Well, first off, we have to continue to protect the funding for Great Lake restoration funding. The federal government funds restoration programs to keep them clean. We have to make sure that that water stays as fresh as possible. We use it for drinking. We use it for agriculture, all of the manufacturing processes. And that restoration funding is under attack. And I will join with members of our delegation to continue to fight to increase that
funding. Can we achieve a physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi water system and the threat that is posed by Asian carp and other invasive species?
Yeah, it is.
Politically doable?
It is tough politically. I'll be perfectly honest. It's very tough politically to do that. We've got to build support in order to do that. There's no question the Asian carp threat is one of the most, if not the most significant threat as well to the Great Lakes and fishing. I was up with the fishing folks on this tour, in fact, who are very concerned about the Asian carp and the impact it's going to have on them. We had marina owners who would ripple throughout the economy. The Corps of Engineers has done a recent study. They gave about 8 different options. They didn't prioritize them.
They did not choose one. Yeah.
They did not, which was not helpful. But we are right now working to get funding for some of the programs to stop the CARB from moving forward, finding kind of choke points where you can put resources to focus it. We've got to continue to build support to make a long-term solution, but we've got to do that nationally. In fact, we talked about that. Part of what the businesses I was with, we've got to build a coalition around the country that folks have to understand that this is not a Michigan issue. This is not a Wisconsin issue or a, you know, Indiana issue. This is really a national issue, that a healthy Great Lakes is important for the entire country. It's not a regional issue. And that's certainly what I advocate very aggressively and will continue to advocate very aggressively in the U.S. Senate.
Okay, I'm going to advocate aggressively for getting to as many questions as we can in the few minutes we have left. Russ in Ann Arbor.
Senator? Hello?
Hello?
We're here.
Hello.
We're here, Russ.
Okay, my last name is Plate, P-L-A-T-T-E. We have
and your question?
The question is, will this senator inspire the energy direction of our nation? What about hemp? The Constitution is written on hemp. You make paper and clothes out of hemp. Why is hemp illegal? Why aren't we making biofuel out of hemp?
Okay, thanks for your question.
Yeah, in fact, I've supported legislation to expand research into the uses of hemp, and certainly it's something that we need to, I believe we have to continue to look at and agree. There's some real opportunities there, and we need to look into it.
Very quickly, federal decriminalization or legalization of marijuana, should that happen?
I think we need to continue to see this happen at the state level. You know, we've got Colorado.
But state laws are in conflict with federal law. Should that federal law be changed?
Perhaps at some point, but I'm waiting to see what happens. We have the laboratory of democracy going on right now in our states, and I'm watching those very closely.
Okay. Sarah in West Bloomfield. Sarah, your question for Congressman Peters.
Yes, hi. I'll just make it straight to the point. So many people now are sick and tired of the partisan games and gridlock in Congress, and it seems like no one can find common ground anymore. I'd actually like to know when you've worked with Republicans and on what, and how you were able to find this common ground.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Well, I think that's absolutely critical. And it's about getting past ideology, past partisanship. I'll just give you one example. I'm currently the co-chair of the House Auto Caucus, and I serve with John Campbell, a Republican from California. We have a close working relationship. We have 63 members of our caucus. Half are Republicans, half are Democrats. And I just worked with a Republican colleague of mine from Ohio to pass legislation to streamline the car buying process, to get rid of unnecessary paperwork, basically bureaucratic paperwork to make it easier to sell cars. We did that, and we got a unanimous support, and that was my working with a Republican colleague from Ohio.
Well, so, give us an instance where you have broken with the majority of the Democratic conference in order to accomplish something.
Well, I mean, I take you're talking about votes and stands.
You choose.
You know, most recently, I broke with a large majority of Democrats to make permanent the research and development tax credit, for example, for R&D. To me, the future of this country and the future for Michigan, and we have just an incredible opportunity here throughout our state, whether you're talking about incubators in Grand Rapids or Flint or Detroit, to have innovation. But something like the research and development tax credit, which really incentivizes the ability to invest in the cutting-edge technologies of tomorrow, that should have been permanent. I voted for it and was in the minority of Democrats that did it because I see it as a good common sense solution to a problem, which is making sure we're incentivizing innovation in this country.
Congressman, we're just about out of time, and in the minute or so that we have left, I'd like you to tell people what you think is at stake should you win or lose in November.
Well, thank you, Rick. And I think what's at stake is that, and why people are frustrated, and I'm frustrated as well, is are sending people to Congress who are willing to find that middle ground, willing to bring people together, Democrats and Republicans together, to solve problems in a common sense, independent way. It's what I've done in the House. It's what I look forward to continue to do in the United States Senate.
You know, you'd be hard-pressed to find an institution less loved than Congress. Is Congress fixable?
It is. As long as you elect people who are willing, it's all about who you send to Congress. If you're willing to elect people who are willing to work on both sides of the aisle, have a demonstrated track record of doing that like I have, but you also have to send people to Congress who are passionate about fighting for middle-class families here in the state of Michigan, who are not afraid to get up on stage and fight for the things that matter to people in this state. That's what I will do in the U.S. Senate, but I will do it in a way that brings people together, in a way that solves problems. If we're not solving problems, we will not be successful.
Quickly, what committee assignments would you seek in the Senate?
I think that's bad karma. So I want to win the election for U.S. Senate, and then I will think about that. I currently serve on Financial Services Committee in the House, which deals with all the financial issues of the country.
All right. Well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Congressman, thank you for taking the time to be with us this hour. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. Again, as we mentioned earlier, the Republican candidate for Michigan Senate seat, Terry Lynn Land, will join us for an hour-long call-in. That will be on October 3rd. Michigan Calling was produced by the fantastic team of Zoe Clark, Joe Lindstruff, Jake Neer, and Laura Weber Davis. Matt Trevethan engineered the program. And thank you very much to WDET in Detroit for hosting the program. I'm Rick Pluta. This has been a special broadcast on the stations of the Michigan Public Radio Network.